Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. As you know, this is our final seminar in this series. I hope you found it beneficial. What kind of things would you like to talk about? Are there questions, comments, reflections that you have from any of the seminars or from just the experience of our exchange or hearing the material? I want to offer to keep open the possible communication about this material and any input or thoughts you have about it. An easy way to reach me is through my website, MentorPath, or just simply the email dkruger, D-K-R-U-E-G-E-R, at MentorPath.com. And any questions or comments, I would welcome those. But I'm interested to hear from you now. Any thoughts and reflections about, did this meet your expectations so far? Are there things that you still would like to talk about? Anyone? Anybody just want to check in and say hi? I know.
Hi, David.
Hey, welcome. Who is this?
This is Vince.
Welcome. Hey, thanks for saying hi. What was your experience of the seminar? I'm eager to get some.
I think it's an unbelievable amount of information. I keep listening to it over again. It's really a lot of great information.
Well, I recognize that it's like a fire hose of information. I hope that's not detracting from the impact. I much prefer a true seminar of discussion, of give and take, but there's just so much that I wanted to convey for information that I thought we could have a conversation by email or in other ways, or just to take in the information and sort of let it marinate, revisit it, put it in your own output channel to look at how it may be helpful for you, for your practices, because this is applicable, as I've mentioned, to all areas of business, education, arts, health, human relationships, sports. It's about any kind of performance and any kind of engagement. And our practice and our facilitation as coaches to be catalysts to help others achieve, but it's also for us, for our own achievement. So thanks for that feedback and input. Anyone else?
I will definitely absorb everything and contact, you know, probably email you or whatever if I have any questions or anything like that. But the information and it fits right into my belief system, so I didn't need to change my beliefs on things. It just the information is just a wealth of information that you give.
What kind of coaching do you do?
I haven't gotten into it yet. It's just far as the belief system, you know, of the whole program is. There's nothing that I'm saying. I think to myself, oh, that doesn't sound right, or I never believe that. It's basically fits right into what I believe as far as stress management and performance enhancing. I always believe in the things that you're teaching. You know, the old Mike Ditka way of doing things, and they do a lot of sports analogies, and I never believed in.
Okay. Well, the important thing is, as I've tried to emphasize, is taking this in and absorbing it and synthesizing and integrating it with your professional story so that you have an enhanced story and will then be able to better help each of your clients write their own stories. So
right.
This is about story development and looking at the elements of that and how to really craft the most optimum story and in this series performance story possible. So, yeah, great. Thanks for that feedback.
And I
welcome any comments or follow-up questions after you've reflected on it, let it marinate it, and put it in your own output channel. to apply it and synthesize it in your own way so that it becomes part of your story. Many years ago, let me tell you how I'm going to predict this will look after it's marinated and it becomes part of your story. Many years ago, while I was still practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis, I worked with a regionally known artist, and he wanted to work with me in an intensive therapy. He wanted to kind of quiet the demons that he had that really drove, as he saw it, his creativity, and he was scared in the beginning that quietening those demons would also kind of modulate his creativity. What he, of course, found was he was free to be even more creative, and he became internationally known once he was free to express that. But the point I want to make is this. He described to me one day what it was like for him to paint. He said, if you and I go to the canvas, and he knew that I was no painter, when I go to the canvas, I get in a zone and I emote on the canvas. And hours later, I stop and look at and reflect on what I've done. Now, at any moment, what I am doing is defined by the 15 years of formal training of line drawing, of color, of human anatomy, and I can look at some, he was an abstract expressionist, I can look at some point on a pointless canvas and say, that stroke and that color means this. But at the time, I'm not thinking about it. I'm just letting it happen. So that's what I'm predicting that each of you will do, to take what you find useful, to absorb it as part of your story. And when you're with a client, you're going to be totally absorbed in the work with that client. You're not going to be thinking about what I should say next or try to deconstruct it to say, well, you know, what this means here is this. But later you can describe it. And I'm going to present a case in part of it. Can I get a management of the background noise? Your microphone is picking up movement and shuffling of paper. You're not hearing it. But we are. So do a mute star six until we're ready to. Thanks. So that kind of experience is kind of an analogy for an artist of being in the flow, that you're informed by years and years of deliberate practice, but in the moment of performance, you're not thinking about the elements of that practice or how to do it, because that would cause an the language that I've used with us, a choke, you know, to move to an observer's platform away from the playing field into your left brain and out of the flow. So that's an illustration. As you become more familiar with this material, just as you have with other material, to incorporate it in terms of what you do and make it part of your professional story, and however you decide to guide or direct that and whoever you decide to work with. Any other brief comment or question before we move into the material? Well, I'll be sure and reserve a time at the end, so if there's anything that you have, jot it down. I want to talk about something that we don't often talk about in terms of training or in mentor coaching, but yet I see it again and again, both with clients I work with and professionals, coaches who I work with in mentor coaching, is the challenge of dealing with extreme success, because we usually think about helping someone get successful. If you ask any player in a physician's basketball league whether he or she could compete with LeBron James, they'd probably laugh. Yet many of those same physicians, and I'm familiar with physicians' basketball leagues, willingly compete with the billionaire investor Warren Buffett. Cognitive biases and mental errors make them believe they can outperform successful full-time investment experts. Those who have achieved in exceptional ways create challenges for themselves in the very attainment of that success. Some highly successful individuals, from expert actors and athletes to practicing medical and legal experts, began to believe that they can be good in other areas, such as investing. Expertise in one area does not equate with expertise in another. Even Warren Buffett recognized this about himself. I don't think being able to allocate capital means you're good at anything else. Overconfidence creates a misperception of ability when it's informed by spectacular success in one area. University of Pennsylvania psychologists Philip Tetlock and Barbara Meller studied over 25,000 forecasts from people whose task was to anticipate how the future would unfold. Their studies, like a number of others, have revealed exceptional overconfidence in the judgments of doctors, lawyers, engineers, scientists, and exceptionally successful people in their decision-making processes. The stimulation of overconfidence is biologically habituating. Look at the recent revelations of politicians, actors, athletes who came to believe that their success made them immune to boundary violations. From Macbeth, we learn that we are most vulnerable not when we're beginning, not even when we're destitute or needy or hungry, but after the biggest triumphs of our lives. For Macbeth, the moment the witches came was after the most massive successes he had ever experienced, winning two battles and enjoying immense popularity. Just look at Elvis, Marilyn, Janice, F. Scott, Kurt, Belushi, Philip Seymour. Some people need mentor coaches not to become successful, but to help them regulate their states of mind, to manage emotions, to sustain success. Complacency and overconfidence become equal challenges. Navigating extreme success creates unique challenges. Exceptional success transcends all usual and expectable categories, such as the athlete who plays very well or defies the limits of physical aging. It also occurs when accomplishments or the result of fame or wealth transcend any possible anticipation, preparation, or even model of how to engage it and handle it. You see in the outline my quote from Keith Richards: fame has killed more talented people than drugs. So I want to talk about a phenomenon that you will see, although you may not have called it this. Success anticlimax. After Bruce Jenner's last decathlon in Montreal, the next morning he asked, "What am I going to do now?" After a long practiced and anticipated success, people often have to deal with success anticlimax. And that's a brain phenomenon as well as a psychological phenomenon. The sprint system mediated by dopamine can sustain the excitement of expectation of anticipating a consequence. As we know from various performers, this can last even for years or decades. This shift, though, from the neurochemical system of the sprint, the excitement of the preparation, to then the marathon system to sustain and balance endeavors can read as a lack of excitement, as if something were missing, even to feeling slightly depressed after the big game, after the crowning achievement of a lifetime. Robert Louis Stevenson said it very simply: to travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive. At least it sustains the dopamine release of the hope and the anticipation. The athletes and executives I've worked with and others I've interviewed have learned to contend with the anticlimax of shifting from stimulating anticipation to sustaining maintenance and to dose anticipation in an effective way. That's where we can come into play as mentor coaches. Let me give you an example here. I vividly recall my favorite athletic coach's first introduction to me of his version of this aspect of sports psychology. It was intuitive for him way back in the day. As a freshman, I was fortunate to make the traveling squad of 12 players in basketball, even though I felt intimidated by the upperclassmen surrounding me for the entire year. Just after we won our first tournament and boarded our bus, Coach stood at the front of the bus and looked at each of us. We were all feeling pretty good at the big win, or series of wins, and eager to get home and celebrate with the parade downtown. He said, "So, we won this tournament. This is not the biggest or the most prestigious tournament that we'll play. In fact, it's kind of a podunk tournament." He paused. "How many of you can actually say you're proud to win this tournament under any circumstances?" I would have raised my hand, and I suspected my teammates would, but nobody dared venture a single finger in the air. He concluded, "Feel good for now, but let's get home and really start working on being an excellent team." Coach knew how to handle success anti-climax. His life-changing coaching and the mentoring of me for 4 years in three sports resulted in many wins, a state championship, all state honors, but most importantly, my resultant two careers of helping others succeed. To me, for me, that's his legacy. For any physical or intellectual achievement, the emotional role and creative closure have to be addressed upon a successful completion. I've known a number of authors who describe a letdown after the completion of their book. One even described it as a postpartum depression. The most successful achievers have evolved their capacities to recover faster from success anticlimax changes, or with the help of a mentor coach, to ladder it and look at what's next. So, to look at high-risk and high-stakes decisions, does proven evidence change beliefs? Facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in our brains. You don't create a change by suddenly introducing a new idea and expecting it to override the one that's already there. Facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. Data is not a way to change anybody's mind. It's simply not how we decide. Established beliefs are extremely resistant to change, even when scientific evidence disproves those beliefs. People regard information, and this is how someone's brain works. This is how your brain works. Deny it though you may. People regard information as valid evidence when it reinforces their existing views. We'll pay attention to something when it fits our identity. This is how arguments are more staunchly solidifying an original position. Presenting someone with information that contradicts an opinion most likely causes that person to generate new counterarguments to further strengthen their view. This is the boomerang effect. You get just the opposite of what you hope. And the brighter someone is, the more they'll be able to rely on that. So people get more confident in their initial convictions and use information to polarize opinions even further. Think about abortion, gun control, climate change, to name a few. We quickly accept evidence that confirms our preconceived notions, and we assess counter evidence with a critical, even disbelieving eye. We then cherry-pick information to fortify our beliefs without even being consciously aware of it. And as I mentioned, recent studies have shown the more intelligent people are, the greater their ability to creatively rationalize and interpret information to fit their opinions. They use their intelligence not to examine data often or to draw more accurate conclusions, but to find fault in data they already disbelieve. The mind's desire for continuity and certainty, coupled with activating the brain's error detection mechanism with new or unexpected information, both contribute to the continuity of belief and action. So let's apply this to success traps in business. Think about it in terms of your business. Think about it in those in business who you do mentor coaching or consultation with. The success trap in business is an almost ubiquitous phenomenon in which a company needs to shift the way it operates in order to survive. And I'm talking about the developmental phase of a business. The canal boat companies of the 1700s did not become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. And in the 1900s, there were no Union Pacific Airlines. They stuck to their box, good to gone. Motorola stuck to their story and slid from a premier electronics firm to a troubled industry. Meanwhile, Nokia asked and listened to children and young people just developing their stories and used their feedback to become world class, good to great. Another example is Kodak, who stuck to analog photography and didn't evolve to digital. More recently, Andy Grove at Intel described the success trap as being a time in an organization's life when the leaders, and think of that as you for your coaching business, have to think differently. And they have to move away from what's worked so far, from organizational rigidity, to develop and refine what's successfully in place, to also incorporate and think creatively of what can be. In other words, not just doing more of what got you there, but to think about what's next, what can be. Grove put it very simply, miss the moment and you start to decline. He noted the difficulty at Intel, as he self-reflected, to move from memory chips to embrace the next technology of microprocessing in order to sustain the viability of the entire company. Successful performance for an individual or company can sustain focus on what created the success rather than looking to the next success. The new success becomes the old success if there's not a new model to evolve and ultimately step into. Attention to execution of the current success may miss the innovation needed to take the next steps forward. A balance of refining and sustaining of what's working combined with creative exploration of the next innovation is a delicate and dynamic balance. This is deliberate practice applied to a system of a business or a team. Brain scans of 63 seasoned business decision makers showed two things. Moving to new territory of exploratory strategies disengages from the pleasing routine of certainty. It makes them uncomfortable, in other words. To leave the default mode to attend to new possibilities is uncomfortable, and it takes more energy to sustain it because you're not sure of the outcome. Yet at the same time, creative innovation stimulates the brain circuitry of anticipation and reward. Now, there's a segment of what I wanted to highlight that more of this is in your outline than we'll talk about. That's performance-related biases and their remedies. I want to just highlight a few things, but I've given you more than I'm going to talk about simply as a reference in your outline, because you're going to hear one or more of these in every client that you work with. So there are some specific biases created or exaggerated by success that can have a unique impact on performance. That's why I'm including the ones here I'm including about the impact on success, often activated by success. Awareness of the tendency of these biases to psychologically influence decisions and dilute optimum performance, I believe, becomes important to recognize. One is self-deception. These self-deceptions have been distilled from a number of studies. I'm only going to talk about the first one here, self-inflation, because this is enhanced, especially at times of significant success. For example, 94% of people place themselves at the top half of their profession. 70% of both men and women feel they're better looking than average. 19% of people believe they're in the top 1% of income. 70% of drivers believe they're better than average. 75% of people consider themselves healthier than average. Another, and I want to refer you to the outline to look at derogation of others, moral superiority, and the illusion of control, some other biases that are there for reference. I want to talk a little bit about invincibility bias. Those of you who have been teenagers before or have teenage kids will instantly recognize this. Here are some common examples of invincibility bias. Adolescents may tend to estimate danger poorly and to exaggerate anticipated performance, so they have risky behavior as a result at times. Heavy smokers underestimate their cancer risk despite objective awareness of danger. Skiers ignore warning signs and enter restricted areas to ski dangerous terrain, sometimes to their peril. And someone sees a roulette wheel stop on red 6 times in a row and believes that the chances are higher than 50-50 that it'll stop on black the next spin. The law of averages, come on. 100% of those who believe the roulette wheel has a memory and will abandon the 50-50 red-black probability is wrong, although about half will win their next bet and be right for the wrong reasons. Optimism bias. This is our tendency to underestimate the possibility of bad events in our lives and to overestimate the possibility of good events. We underestimate the likelihood of a car accident, of having cancer, overestimate our life expectancy and our future income. Newlyweds estimate the likelihood of divorce at 0%. Statistically, 40% of them will be wrong. Another, hindsight bias. Knowing how things turned out can influence the way we remember and even reframe past events to make an outcome seem inevitable. And that is typically called now, because of the book and the common language, the Black Swan effect, based on Nassim Taleb's book, The Black Swan Effect, looking at how people believed that there were only white swans because that's all they had ever seen in the world to that time. And then when Australia was discovered, people saw black swans and they said, well, of course, we predicted that. Well, of course they're black swans since they're white swans. So this is a way of explaining things that could never have been predicted. The improbable things, but as you look back, well, yeah, like 9/11, like the Internet. Subjectivity bias. We have an ability to spot thinking and systematic errors in others, yet at times we may struggle to look objectively to assess our own. We can spot biases way more readily in our friends than in ourselves. They have a lot more than we do, simply because we are observers of them. And we can't as easily bring into objective focus our own process of thinking and behaving. Present bias. We put great value in the present, so much so that it makes and takes a massive future reward to forego the impulse or pleasure of the present in order to invest in the future. Because the future is, after all, an abstraction. It's a distant notion. There is no reward system in the brain to reward looking to the future. There is an immediate reward system for present things like spending, like taking risks, like drugs. The dopamine system asks what's next, and that's all the dopamine system is concerned about. People jeopardize their future for instant pleasure in the present, whether it's indulging in unhealthy snacks, procrastinating on exercise, or spending now in lieu of saving for the future. Nutrition and exercise for longevity can be trumped by the immediate pleasure of eating. People with a present bias invest less in their retirement account or their future health. And again, the present is now. There's an immediate, or the future is a theory and an abstraction. So it doesn't compete well with the immediate reward of the pleasure chemical of dopamine. Here's something to consider. A transparency bias. When we perceive fairness, the brain releases the pleasure chemical. When we perceive unfairness, this triggers the reptilian brain that mediates a perception of threat and survival, even if in a mild way, with its own neurochemical system. Fairness, a keystone in both collaboration and leadership, can be overridden by the sense of unfairness that it can interfere with creativity, motivation, and teamwork. A major factor in our perception of fairness is transparency, the work or the effort that we perceive that goes into a task. We often use the amount of effort we see as a shortcut to the perception of value. So when something takes little time or looks easy, or when the work itself is not visible, not transparent to the recipient, we react in significant ways. An example is an attorney. An attorney who charges $600 an hour for work that's not transparent. You can imagine maybe 5 minutes of that, but 60 minutes? Or a plumber charging $200 for a visit when the actual repair work only takes 2 minutes. Here's an illustration of this from a study. If two people who live together are put in separate rooms and each ask the amount of housework the other does, the combined figure is always more than 100%. There's a transparency asymmetry. Each is aware primarily of his or her own work, but unaware of the extent of the work of the other. We value and we perceive more accurately what is transparent. And we often attach a money value to what we value. Now, here's an example of a projection bias. Then I want to spend a little bit of time looking at bias remedies. We're going to cure all of this in just a minute. A projection bias is that we believe that other people hold the same beliefs and values that we do and will into the future, unless we're really self-reflective. Think about this in terms of fan psychology. Fan psychology employs some innate projection bias, as being a fan of a particular team or group, by definition, distorts thinking and creates biases. We identify with a player or a performer or a team or organization, and our thinking influences our behavior. This automatically frames how we view a call by a referee, for example, and we immediately lapse into all or nothing good or bad thinking. Another example is seeing how ethnocentric our own views in the United States are when traveling to different parts of the world. A projection of our belief or value onto another instantly creates a connection, on the other hand. Both projection bias as well as fan psychology are motivated in part by belonging, of identifying with a group that shares beliefs and values that resonates with our own identity. So here's a mentor coaching application of some bias remedies. Now, a bias simply means that we not only ignore certain data, but we specifically ignore disconfirming data. Facts contrary to our beliefs and our self-images get dismissed or simply not seen, not engaged. A cue for a bias can be simply an anchor for booting up a particular mindset. We have biases that we are not even consciously aware of, that we would actually consciously abhor. A cue for a bias can simply be race, gender, weight, any number of other things that automatically and largely unconsciously get associated in our minds. Then natural gravitation occurs to others who share the same mindset or beliefs to engage in groupthink to further the notions and find evidence to confirm them or affirm them. Look at what's happening politically right now. Groupthink can simply be shared blind spots. We ignore contrary evidence and share a self-deception. We work diligently to preserve our opinions, even though we may not consciously know exactly what they are. The challenge, then, is look at the back at the roadmap in your exercise. The first three steps of the roadmap: to recognize, own, and assess certain aspects of our stories. The primary reason it's a challenge, the bias is a challenge, new information may cause unpleasant feelings. New information may demand a change in beliefs. We seek information that confirms our beliefs rather than often being open to ones that disprove them. And new information can require us to take undesired actions. That's why a systematic process like the roadmap for performance, or even to look at beliefs in this application, can be useful to recognize, own, assess, and then decide how to proceed. To leave the security of our known stories, the certainty and predictability of how they'll turn out, can feel like a lack of control. We are motivated to avoid new information, especially if we expect bad news or something unknown. Seeking a consultation with a doctor about certain symptoms confronts the denial and the pain of undergoing testing and hearing something we don't want to hear. It's also more difficult when the information is hard to understand or interpret. So we first have to realize what we don't know. This is difficult because how do you come to know what you don't know? Candid, open feedback from trusted others, that means you, the mentor coach, once you've established the working alliance with a client, becomes one way. In executive coaching, I've also used a 360-degree assessment instrument to have someone self-assess and then get assessments on the same questions about them from a group of people who are close to that person and know quite well and submit it anonymously. This can challenge the comfort zone, but it provides objective, valuable information. Now, a word about the hubris syndrome. If you don't know what this is, turn on MSNBC or turn on CNN tonight, and you're going to see a reference to it, though they won't call it this. While confidence is a state of mind that generates remarkable productivity, overconfidence can become a slayer of success. While our minds constantly learn from challenges, internally and externally, the creative and empathic process can be derailed by the complacency of power. It's been shown that the more we know and the better that we become, the more likely we are to overestimate our own ability as well as underestimate the events beyond our control. In one study, CEOs became more confident as they gained merger and acquisition experience, resulting in their overvaluation of subsequent deals. In research from the University of Vienna, investors who obtained significant experience with their market became overconfident and made risky asset trades. Overconfidence and the brain's potentiation of stimulation enhances with sustained success and power. It creates an excitement, and we want more of it. We at least want to sustain it. Blind certainty from that state can replace active self-reflection. Overconfidence increases with familiarity, repetition, information, and success. One of the best predictors of overconfidence is power, which enhances with time and experience and can result in the cessation of questioning alternate possibilities. Instead of asking, who am I thinking about now, let's talk about talent. A growth mindset recognizes talent as something that can be enhanced through dedication and deliberate practice. A fixed mindset sees talent as either present or not present, not as something to be developed. Edwin Moses, winner of 107 consecutive races and four world records as part of that series, said, I ran against a lot of individuals who were probably more physically talented. We now know from a number of perspectives that talent is not a genetic gift, but a developmental process. It can be enhanced when it's recognized, focused on, nurtured by parents, teachers, coaches, mentors. Discipline and deliberate practice evolve both intellectual and physical talent. Discipline, deliberate practice. The social setting and enhancing framework can contribute both to motivation and maturation of talent. Now, it's a lot easier when you think about recognizing and advancing sports talent, and especially the more socially prominent areas. Basketball, baseball in the United States, soccer in England, ice hockey in Canada. Sports make it easy because they're so visible, they're identifiable, they're measurable. Talent in other areas may not be as easily recognized, perhaps not even visible, not transparent. Talent in art, in verbal ability, physical and mental skills become challenges to identify and to facilitate. While there are different innate physical and mental capacities, just as individual personality and learning styles, the developmental process must be systematically nurtured by discipline and practice. The optimum model evolved from various studies that I've looked at about the development of expertise and talent includes these three aspects: early diversification, sampling of a number of activities, exposure for both informed choices, and long-term development. Let me just mention this briefly. For early diversification, I mean, you know, your kids are exposed to all the sports, so they can pick what they like. I've had the privilege of working with two child prodigies who, from early on, one age four and one age five, had their lives devoted for them to the development of their talent. I saw them in their early 20s when they were sort of burned out, but mostly scared because they had no other abilities. They had devoted their entire life and energy to developing that talent. They were world class, but they needed some help in doing some other things. So a composite of studies of elite performers across a number of fields have found these common traits that characterize development and expertise of talent. Managing anxiety in pressure situations. This is a summary of what we've been talking about. Confidence, mental toughness and resilience, the ability to focus and to block distractions, in other words, to stay focused, a hard work ethic, development of resilience, in other words, as that manifests, the practice of setting and achieving goals, being coachable, and optimism. And a disadvantage of talent, this is sort of a sidebar here, the talent myth assumes a fixed mindset. Why spend time and energy trying to improve if success only comes to people with the right talent or the right genes? I saw a study today, actually, that indicates that genes form 7% of the ultimate outcome of the things that are usually attributed to genes, and I'm not going to go into detail here. That skill and intelligence can be improved is a growth mindset. And we're going to talk about that as a kind of a end point to frame all of this. Talent can be a potential disadvantage in this way because someone with a natural talent may not at the very beginning of skill, like my two prodigies, subject himself or herself to the same hard work, the rigors, the dedication of someone without those talents, even within a particular sport or area of accomplishment. Natural talent can suffice for a period of time, but if it replaces the discipline and dedication to practice that needs to be developed, it can be a disadvantage. It comes easy long enough that somebody hasn't learned hard work, ethics of work, and resilience. those with less skills early on have to work harder to develop them, and that may establish a systematic way to grow and improve in this process. They develop a model of how to do this. They may also develop related skills to supplement their achievement, such as knowing their opponent, engaging strategies, and other adaptations. Without relying totally on a natural athletic or intellectual capacity, they persevere through adversity to hone a foundation of repeatable strategies and skill development. Everything I'm talking about is something that we do as mentor coaches with certain clients. A shadow story of talent is that it can mask poor teaching or coaching for a significant period of time, or even until it's time to play a bigger game in some challenging way, intellectually or physically. I've been a consultant to organizations where that has been the hidden factor for a leader. Now, let's look at sustainable success for just a moment, and then I want to conclude with some things that are going to summarize exactly what we've been talking about, though in a very different way. After their first unprecedentedly successful whirlwind tour of the United States, the first thing the Beatles did when they got back to England was to go to the studio and make their next album. And they made a new album regularly every 6 months. They didn't bask in their glory or let it derail their plans. They consolidated the success to integrate it with ongoing focus and plans. They pressed their advantage, but they did not let success derail their plans or hijack their focus. Here's an application. A client I'll call Evelyn consulted me because she was having burnout in her career. She'd enjoyed remarkable and rapid success as an actress, moving quickly through local theater productions, national commercials, and a role in a nationally syndicated series. Her energy brightened a room, induced optimism in others. She was a kind of a force of nature when she walked in the room, and people were impressed with her imaginative and creative presence. Being highly intuitive and sensitive allowed her attunement and connection to others, as well as a total immersion in the character she played. With this sensitivity came the resonance with stressful emotions from those around her, resulting in feeling emotionally drained, especially by crowds. She described her sensitivity to family and friends, especially by fans who would approach her at restaurants and public places wanting her autographs or a selfie with her. She wanted to please them, enjoyed the popularity, but often felt depleted after these experiences. She questioned whether the burnout meant that she was not suited for what she was doing, even though she enjoyed the recognition and the stardom and was passionate about her work and developing her craft. We explored her state of mind after these experiences. She described how she had to go home because she was depleted and would feel drained for hours. Even a nap would not restore her energy. Her high degree of creativity and imagination was a natural for her expert work, but she didn't have or use the necessary buffers and boundaries to regulate her state of mind in her private time. So the result was depletion. She needed to develop an internal point of reference even more than most individuals, as her intuitive, empathic style, at times selfless, was eroding the joy from her accomplishments. Now, this is what I think that you will find for people who move to extreme fame, wealth, accomplishment, that they may not have a model for that, and they will have to even more be attuned to an internal point of reference to not lose their internal anchor, their sense of purpose, their why, their true north. So we focused on her desire to resonate with and nurture others that needed to be developed within herself first, to not abandon herself, to remain grounded in her own experience. She then developed a way to carve out her private space and a time devoted to her needs and develop specific boundaries in her interface with others. these pragmatic strategies allowed her to preserve her energy and to deploy it by conscious choice rather than in a reactive mode. For example, she developed an awareness of how the character that she inhabited for a screen role was itself a state of mind and how to effectively enter and exit that state of mind each day so that she could preserve her own private space and not intermingle the two. She learned to dose time and titrate exposure to others, reduce the excessive stimulation of crowds, especially of needy or negative people, was reframed as a necessary point of self-care, not feeling guilty at saying no to fans. She built in quiet time to emotionally decompress and recharge. She learned the value of mindfulness meditation, of calming mini breaks through the day, to do 2-minute mindfulness meditations as a response to signals that might otherwise have triggered a default mode of reactivity. So by protecting herself in this way and being attuned to the necessary boundaries between herself and others, she maintained her valued sensitivity and empathic resonance, beginning with herself without absorbing the impact of the feelings of others. So there's more to this, but I want to... She was a very visual person, so her mantra included a visual focus rather than a word phrase. She envisioned being enveloped in a cone of white warm light around her entire body that offered energy as well as protection. It blocked any negativity as well as restored her own energy and internal point of reference. This capacity for full emotional engagement and empathic attunement generated significant success and awards in her acting role, because after she did her research, she could become the character she played and had an amazing empathic ability, but then she preserved herself at the end of the day so she could more fully immerse herself in both. She recognized how to automatically put the needs of others in their perspective, so her career soared even higher. So, finally, I want to end with this. These are some differences, and these are essentially in your outline. This is a summary. A difference between experts and amateurs. I think I have this quote in the outline. This is from Bum Phillips to rookie running back Earl Campbell. When you get to the end zone, act like you've been there before. So here are some experts, here are some differences between expert and amateur, because expert and amateur are each states of mind. This is how I'd like you to hear this. The expert is an ideal, a contrast to the amateur. Evolution from amateur to expert, which you're going to help people do with mentor coaching, is a significant life-changing passage when it occurs. These following distinctions can apply to that process of transformation. Experts continue concentrated, deliberate practice on focused areas to develop with informed feedback. Amateurs get to a level of good enough and stay there. Experts seek practice and goals that exceed current levels of performance. Amateurs seek to sustain a comfort level and not challenge it. Experts understand there is no predetermined limit of ability. Amateurs believe there is a fixed reserve of potential. The expert works from love, passion, dedication. Failure is information to guide proceeding. The amateur may be sidetracked by setback, and failure is validation not to proceed. The expert loves and pursues the game, whatever the game is, with total dedication and passion. The amateur pursues it as a sideline, as part-time, like a weekend warrior. The expert keeps going no matter what. The amateur is dissuaded by setback and adversity. The expert does what's important first. Amateurs do what's urgent first. The expert is on a mission, knows that fear can never be overcome, and recognizes that the best indication of what's next may be what also generates the most fear. The expert knows that once action has begun, fear will recede like your lap when you get up to walk. Even fear can be redefined as excitement. The amateur must first overcome the fear, believing that comfortable is a prerequisite to begin. The expert knows that fairness is a childhood wish, that in adulthood there's not even an ultimate arbiter of fair. There's always adversity, unlevel fields, bad hops, rotten calls, injustice, unfairness. The amateur seeks fairness and is set back at what does not seem fair. The expert does whatever it takes, even what could never have been imagined. The amateur needs predictability, consistency, assuredness of results. The expert respects the craft but is not superior to it, recognizing the contribution of those who have gone before. The amateur believes in inherent luck, intelligence, and waits for inspiration. The expert dedicates to mastery. The amateur dedicates to proving himself or herself, needing to consistently demonstrate superiority and confidence. The expert does not take things or people personally, recognizes that others always make self-statement, does not succumb to criticism, envy, or idealization of others. The amateur is subject to the perception of others, to rejection, and reads the responses of others as if looking into an accurate mirror of a valid reflection. The expert self-regulates and self-validates, takes in new information, but does not let it determine meaning. The amateur becomes an extension of the interest, desire, and needs of others, is vulnerably reliant on the perception and feedback of others. The expert has an internal point of reference and is proactive. The amateur has an external point of reference, is reactive. This will go up to and maybe over, speaking of boundaries, our time, but I want to finish these and I'll hang around if there are questions or comments. The expert seeks the mastery of art as work, deliberate practice as lifestyle, success as creation. The amateur believes that art is inspiration, talent is innate, and seeks the lucky break. The expert believes that the architect of magic is informed persistence and dedicated resilience. The amateur believes that magic is magic. The expert shows up every day no matter what and is committed for the long haul, understanding that delayed gratification is the ant, not the grasshopper, the tortoise, not the hare. The amateur shows up as long as something else doesn't get in the way. The amateur looks for shortcuts, quick results, and immediate gratification. Experts know they can do best that which they do uniquely well. The amateur tries to do a bunch of things, to be everything to many people. The expert knows that the self and every storyline in life are created moment by moment, that the ultimate abandonment is of oneself. The amateur believes that much is predetermined, some fate, some circumstance, some luck, that consistent attention must be given to be appreciated and accepted by others. The expert believes that we write, live, and create in order to know. The amateur believes that we must know in order to write, live, and create. Experts add value to their art, science, expert body of knowledge, and to others. Amateurs add value to themselves. The expert believes that certainty develops with proceeding and mastery. The amateur must have certainty in order to proceed. The expert, even at times a warrior, believes in humility and modesty. The amateur believes in never showing vulnerability, doubt, or uncertainty. The expert punches through the bag, runs through the finish line. The amateur hits the front of the bag and relaxes at the finish line. And special thanks for that metaphor. I'll mention to whom in our discussion. The expert knows that courage is to proceed despite fear. The amateur believes that courage is the absence of fear. So, in conclusion, the anticipation, the application, really, of these principles of stress mastery and peak performance that we've been talking about for these four seminars apply to all areas of business, education, health, arts, human relationships, sports. As we become more self-reflective and better learners, we more effectively write our own stories, whether life, career, wellness, relationship, money, or any other. All are contributions to ourselves. We're in discussion mode now. If you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in any comments. And I'll hang around. I know our official time is up, but are there questions or things that you'd like to talk about? Thanks for that and some other reference to Lisa Manyalki in New Jersey. She is in attendance, whether virtually or by recorded session. Questions, comments, thoughts? Is this what you expected, or did you get what you hoped for, or not, or something different?
Hi, this is Patrick.
It was better.
Please, go ahead.
For me, this is Patrick again. For me, I think that's exactly what I was looking for, especially last week's session on play to win or playing not to lose. That's what for me, that was a big part of the class, because what I want to do is actually really work with young athletes.
Oh yeah,
yeah, and that actually really fit well with me on what I'm going to do. And I think when you look at that and use football as the analogy, as far as you see it all the time in football games, if the team's already winning, the coaches, they decide that they want to play cover two, but now they're playing not to lose instead of to win. And normally when you play the cover two, you end up losing.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And this material, and I appreciate the feedback that you're giving and that others have given, this material is what I'm developing into a training program that will be a licensed specialty certification for the NeuroMentor Peak Performance Institute to train, you know, people in peak performance or groups or coaches or executives for teams in peak performance. So I really appreciate the feedback that you're giving me. So thanks Patrick for that. And I think it's an exciting application to look at working with athletes, kind of a natural from some of this material.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're very welcome. And now for the course that you're developing, are you going to be offering that, or how is that going to work out?
That is in process. I spend September of each year immersed in writing in an old Creole home in a quiet part of the French Quarter in the courtyard, and I began this writing project to develop a book, a training program, a client workbook, as well as some of this material this September, and it's evolving. It will be a while before I'm ready to offer it, but that's why I wanted to offer an initial glimpse of some of the material and get feedback and develop that, and I'll likely develop this into a webinar for organizations, but I'll be interested in looking at what each of you are developing and if I can be of help to you in what you're doing in your coaching or in the development of your program. So I'll be eager to hear what you're up to, how you apply it, and any questions or ways that I could be of help.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Super. Other comments, questions, or thoughts? Anything else that would be useful for us to talk about as we wrap up? Well, thank you for your participation, your energy, the comments, the kind words that you've sent by email. And I would love to hear from you. If you have other thoughts or reflections, or if I can be of help to you in any way, just let me know. Thanks very, very much. And I hope our paths cross again. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.